News Talk Breakfast, in association with AIR, supporting your business on our mobile network right across Ireland.
Thanks, Oisin. You're welcome to Breakfast Business with Vincent Wall. Coming up in the next half hour, we assess whether sellers of investment products are ensuring their clients' suitability for risk-taking. And we assess whether there may have been some French mustard on the British roast beef at Macron and May's dinner last night. But first, Aidan Donnelly has returned from his trip to Trumpland to join us to review latest news and market developments. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Did it take you long to come up with that French mustard line, did it?
I tell you, I have a whole team of scriptwriters.
Oh, very good. Yeah.
Speaking of Trumpland, news overnight that Ryanair chairman David Bonderman is in trouble for a remark he made in San Francisco yesterday.
Yeah, he's quit the... It was at a meeting of the board of Uber, the taxi or the ride share company in San Francisco. And this has kind of flowed on from a few issues dating back as far as February of this year, when one of their lead engineers quit and complained about sexism within the company, and there'd been a board meeting pulled together to basically talk about gender equality, internal gender bias and gender equality within the company. And one of the other board members was just about to stand up. Arianna Huffington of the Huffington Post fame. Yeah, she's also on the board. Just about to stand up and say something. And he made a rather badly timed and quite offensive comment.
A joke.
Well, he thought it was a joke. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's all obviously was quite surprising to everybody that was there, and by the sounds of it, it was more just a board meeting, it was a much wider thing. So the upshot of it was he's obviously been forced to apologise for the sexist joke, and he's quit the board as a result of that. So
yeah, so it's embarrassing, I suppose, if nothing else for a man of his profile.
I would say that definitely. Yeah.
Okay, coming back home here, and I know you can't say a whole lot about the AIB flotation on the basis that you work for Davy, one of the members of the global joint coordinating committee, but announced last night to the market that at least in terms of the current offer spread price, 390 to 490 a share, there is sufficient market demand.
Yeah, it's the story. Joe Brennan's covering it in the Irish Times. It's just, yeah, the Department of Finance announced last night that the maximum amount of stake that can be sold has actually been what's called covered. So they have bids in for that amount of shares at the 390 level. And again, this is only day one of the next week or so. And, you know, this is when the real book begins to build. And they obviously have to talk to all potential interested parties, and they'll start building that book wider. So you'll see the coverage rate move a higher up through that pricing range until it ultimately settles at on the day.
So I suppose the good news for the minister and I suppose the taxpayer is that at least there's a floor level there now. That
correct?
That
if they wanted to do it today and close it out, they could absolutely. They have demand to do it. So it just shows that there is definitely demand for the stock. Obviously, you know, the share price was down quite a bit yesterday, down 14%, down to 560, which is still above where it was. And I suppose it harks back to Minister Noonan's shots across the bow to all the shareholders many months ago that the share price at that stage was overvalued, but it didn't stop it. It hit nearly 9.20 a couple of weeks ago.
The so-called Egypt trade.
Yeah, well,
and it may have been down 14%, but it's still ahead of light.
Where it is, yeah. So, you know, I expect it to be under more pressure all the way until it gets back down to the actual range.
All the papers picking up this morning and very nice computer graphic generated images of how RTE's Donnybrook campus might look when everything is built, but a huge price paid for the nearly 9 acres there.
Yes, certainly is. This was your stamping ground at one stage, wasn't it?
It was. Well, I certainly would have added to it.
Whether legitimately or otherwise, you were certainly found wandering around Montrose. They've sold the site in Donnybrook to Cairn Homes, £107.5 million, which significantly above the guide price. So obviously the estate agent Savills did a very good job. The guide price was £75 million. Cairns have bought it for £107.5 million. What they're planning to do is about 500 apartments and 9 houses on the site. They will have to give the usual 10% of the land or the units to the local authority for social and affordable housing. But I think, obviously, the company raised 52 million in March via a share placing, so they must have had this on their mind almost back at that stage.
And they obviously had the firepower in terms of that equity to outbid other.
Yes, definitely. And I'd say the fact that they had that, the cash in the pocket, and you know, it is substantially higher than the guide price. So you know, it was probably one of these knockout bids. From the perspective of RTE, you know, the Director General saying the funds are going to be used in to invest in much needed capital projects, including technology upgrades and digital infrastructure. So it'll go to good use.
Ultimately, though, I suppose the higher price paid will transfer into the price of the residential units in the end.
Got to make money. Builders got to make money.
We won't dwell too long on the next story, but it is the lead story in the Telegraph. Theresa May planning to plough ahead with negotiations next week and to her commitment to leave the single market.
Yeah, there seems to be an awful lot of cross communications coming out of the UK. Obviously, you know, Theresa May is out saying that she's going to press ahead with exactly the plan she has. And when, you know, you would have thought, given the results from the election last week, she would feel she's on less solid ground. And certainly given the fact that she ends up being partnered with the DUP, they certainly don't want a hard Brexit. So it's going to be very interesting to see ultimately how she plays this one out. I think there's been a few in her party that have been certainly looking for a more convivial approach to how negotiations are going to carry on. Obviously, John Major was out there yesterday, but you know, she has put her foot down in terms of some of her appointments. Michael Gove, obviously, is the prime highlight of that. You know, so I think certainly from the perspective of the going into the negotiations next week, the European side are getting rather frustrated and impatient, waiting for it to come through. So we'll wait and see.
We'll be talking about that to Dick Bullman in a few minutes. Finally,
you were
in the States last week, but the slide in tech stocks halted yesterday temporarily, at least.
Yeah, temporarily at least. It'll be very interesting to see how it'll pan out over the next couple of days. Obviously, we very weak Friday, on Monday. We saw a little bit of a bounce back yesterday, and certainly Fed through to European markets. Look, ultimately, this is the tech sector has been the best stock or the best performing sector so far this year. You know, even after the move on Friday and Monday, there was still probably people sitting on 20-25% gains year to date, which is massive. So, you know, from the perspective of people who were coming into the summer, it's traditionally a very quiet time. People want to maybe square books and say, listen, we've had a good start of the year, let's just take some profits here. And I think ultimately that's what it was. Whether it shakes a few of the retail investors out and would be interesting to see, because you know, we've obviously seen an awful lot of ETF. We've talked about the exchange traded funds and the passive investing over the last couple of weeks, and you know, that obviously does have an implication. Certainly the volumes in the rebound were not nearly as strong as they were in the sell off, so next couple of days I think are going to be key to see ultimately how this pans out.
Okay, interesting one to watch. Aidan Donnelly, welcome back and thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
As always, it's 6:44, you're listening to Breakfast Business with Vincent Wall. The Financial Ombudsman Service in the United Kingdom has found in favour of a client of Zurich Life, who claimed advice given to her had exposed her money to too much risk, and that was despite Zurich's claims it had established her attitude to risk. The case and others begs the question as to how suitability for investment risk is assessed here. Owen McGee of Prosperous Financial Planning is with me in studio. Owen, I know this is something you feel strongly about.
Yeah, I do. I feel very strongly about this, Vincent. And I think it's not a unique problem to the UK in any way. And it's a problem on both sides. It's not just a problem for that client in that particular circumstance, or for Zurich Life, who happened to be the one on the other end of it giving the investment advice. But it's a problem for worldwide for this industry. How do you decide what is suitable? Now, the regulation does give us some steer on that. So what the regulation will say to us is that you must know your client. So you must know who they are. You must know what they own, what they owe, what they earn, what they spend, but also their dependence, their health history, their previous experience investing or having exposure to financial products is also very important. And once you've ticked those boxes, you can become compliant, and that's to get to know your client. The second element then from an investment advice perspective is around suitability. And this to me is a little bit more there's no hard and fast rules. It's not about your age and your date of birth and everything else. There's no hard facts. It's just proving that you believe this investment is suitable for this client. The main way that that's done is using, and this is where I think the industry falls short, just using a simple thing called an attitude to risk questionnaire. And these are psychometric tests, and it all sounds very complicated. But basically, they'll ask you usually up to around 25 questions, and they ask you the same questions in different ways to see if you give them the same answers or consistent answers. And what these tests do is they spit out a number. And the number is typically 1 to 7, 1 being a really safe investor and 7 being a really aggressive investor. And they spit out a number, and 66% of people, or 2/3 of people, come out as a 4, slap bang in the middle.
Yeah.
And then what they do is they say, well, all of our funds are rated on a 1 to 7 basis, so here's all our 4 funds and stick it in there. Now, the big problem I have with that is attitude to risk is one component. What tests have proved, like there's a company called Philometrica who are based in Australia, they've done over 1 million attitude to risk questionnaires in their 20 years in existence. And what they find is as you get older, your attitude to risk doesn't actually change. So if you think about that, if your attitude to risk at 25 is the same as it is at 75, but your time horizons are different, everything else is different. Not only that, at 25, you're probably putting money in. At 75, you're probably taking money out. So if you just concentrate on the one element of attitude to risk, you're leaving a whole pile of other stuff on the side, and you're ignoring it completely.
And what do you believe? What other questions or what other tests do you believe should be done?
There's two tests that we do. To get to know the client a bit beyond than just the facts and figures and what they're actually trying to achieve and what they're trying to do and their time horizon and everything else. But then there's two key components, in my opinion. They are your capacity for loss. And what I mean by that is that if you're going to put this money away and another 2008 happens, is it going to wipe you out? Because if it's going to wipe you out, we need to take a more conservative approach, okay? And we always go back to the last worst case, and in that case it's 2008. And when we have another worst case, we'll then go back to that. But for the moment, we go back to 2008. The key one, though, for me, is required rate of return, okay? So, Vincent, let me take you as an example, if you don't mind, right? Mm-hmm. Imagine that you have planned out your life. We know what you want to do. We know what money you need for the rest of your life. And that's what financial planning is. We know what money you want to spend for the rest of your life. And we know you only need 2% growth per annum. Just let's call it 2% growth per annum. But you have a really high attitude risk because you're really aggressive and you know the markets and you believe that you can get it right. But you also have a really high capacity for us. So if another 2008 happens, it's not going to impact you because you're loaded, Vincent. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to impact you. But you've a low required rate of return. So why bother taking all that risk? Why move up that risk scale when you don't need to? And I think that's where the industry could really start focusing on in terms of putting more weight on the required rate of return.
But who's going to get the industry to do this? We know the industry rarely moves unless it's forced to. Should this be the regulator, the central bank?
I think that the regulator is entitled to their position in terms of making it suitable and putting the onus. And I think the onus has to be on the industry to make it suitable, because then it's much more adaptable and it's quicker to get it right. I also think, though, that the client, I think if you're an individual who's investing money, there's an onus on you to say, yeah, okay, I got the advice and he told me it was the right thing to do. But is it the right thing to do? And make sure that you're satisfied that it suits your particular circumstances.
One last question. Couldn't the industry say, if you have to go back and advise people, can you take a really extreme market crash, say, for instance? Could you absorb that loss? People won't invest at all.
They mightn't invest at all, but you know what? We always gear up clients. I can't say for the entire industry. All I can do is talk about what I do and what we do in our business. And what we do in our business is we tell them, look, not only is it at 32, if 2008 happens, this portfolio would go down by 32% or would go down by 12%, depending on how conservative it is. We tell them in monetary terms, because one of the things I promise clients when we're putting money away is we will have good years, but I promise you we're going to have bad years as well. We expect them to happen. You're going to lose 20% on this investment, for example, at some stage. And in monetary terms, you're going to lose X amount of money, because the worst thing you can do at that point is pull the plug. And that's what we're trying to protect clients from, is themselves.
Okay, you have been warned. Owen McGee of Prosperous Financial Planning, thanks as always for joining us. It's 6:53 on Breakfast Business. Now, newly elected French President Emmanuel Macron hosted barely elected Theresa May to dinner in Paris last night. All smiles for the camera, of course, but the agenda may have been slightly less palatable for the British Prime Minister than the menu. Nick Bullman of Czech Risk, an old friend of this programme, is a key observer of politics and economics in both countries and joins us now in studio. Nick, probably a harsh message enough from Macron to Theresa May in the wake of that election.
Good morning. Yes, Vincent, I think I suspect Theresa was choking over the appetizer, and obviously a very cheeky message right at the end that if you want to come back into the fold, you can at any point. So it's not easy for Theresa May, and I suspect the agenda for Europe is marching on no matter what.
The real issue here being that the word you're hearing from Brussels and others are hearing from Brussels and from European capitals is the EU now is united that a hard Brexit is on.
I think that the EU has decided, both at country level, so Germany and in France, and France will follow the German lead because they have to, and we can talk a little bit about that later. But I suspect that at country level, they've decided a hard Brexit is the only option, and certainly Michel Barnier, who's leading the negotiations on behalf of the EU, has decided it's going to be a hard Brexit. And the simple reason for that is that the risk of contagion in Europe is greater than the risk of shooting themselves in the foot economically short term. And Europe tends to make political decisions ahead of economic decisions, and therefore hard Brexit is the route.
Is it not the case that Emmanuel Macron, you know, with the strong vote he got personally as president, and now his new party dominating the new French Parliament, that he might be in a position to be more generous to the UK and Theresa May, give them a bit of time? Or is he... Well, is he very indebted to Germany?
I think there's an underlying current here that En Marche, there's a two-edged sword. First of all, if you win an absolute majority in the National Assembly, as he has, you've got nowhere to hide. So if, you know, conversely, politicians would prefer to have a little bit of opposition, because that means that if their program fails at any point, that they've got something to blame. Macron doesn't have that, and... he is on a new mandate. The French will push him forward. And it's just a question of when does he run into the inevitable problem in France, which is labor laws. He is indebted to Germany because Germany, Merkel has made it very clear that they will give him a little bit of space on the budget. And he really needs that. He'll need that for the next 2 or 3 years.
This is the 3% budget deficit that he is supposed to be under, like all EU countries.
Correct. And I think so. To get the French economy going again, I suspect that he needs a little bit of leeway from the Germans. The quid pro quo of that is that he will have to support Germany on hard Brexit. So I don't think the French are incentivized at all to have a soft Brexit or to negotiate anything of the sort with regard to the UK on that.
And that begs the question as to why Angela Merkel and the Germans are so insistent on a hard Brexit.
The reason for the Germans being so intransigent on this is really simple at the end of the day. They recognise that the biggest existential risk for Europe is a successful Brexit for the UK. If the UK leaves, and remember, so far the UK economy has actually been steaming ahead. Sterling has been very weak. That's been a huge impetus to export companies. The UK economy looks pretty good. If the UK leaves Europe under a positive note, in other words, the economy booming, unemployment at low levels, then it presents an existential risk. And that would cost the Germans a fortune to put right.
On the basis that other countries may want to follow.
Absolutely. And there are plenty waiting in the wings. There's Italy, there's Denmark, Holland. A lot of people observing how Brexit takes place. So to my mind, the biggest risk in Europe, and I've heard this isn't conjecture, I've heard this from politicians in off-the-record comments, the biggest problem is contagion risk in Europe.
Finally, just and briefly, Nick, just getting back to Macron in France, do you think he can succeed in terms of the labour law changes where others failed?
I very much doubt it. I think the French will say, we voted you in and we absolutely like this new wave of energy that you're bringing, and then they're going to put the brakes on. And as soon as he starts trying to force labour law changes, the unions are going to present some problems for him, and I suspect we'll be back to the old routine in France.
Tout ça change. Nick Bullman of Checkris, thank as always for joining us. That's it from Breakfast Business with Vincent Wall for this morning. I'll be back with bulletins at 7:30 and 8:30. If you missed any of this morning's programme, you can catch us on newstalk.com. The podcast will be there later today. Back to this morning, and after the traffic news, is over to Paul and Shane with all the stories of the morning on Newstalk Breakfast. Stay tuned.